Emily Sweat.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for joining me. Thanks for coming to my place. I got a bunch of construction going on right now, so I really appreciate you coming up for that.
You have a nice place. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, up on the hill. Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty pumped about after our last conversation about Magruder. And I can't remember. I know we were like looking at dates, and I was like, man, it'd be cool if it's Friday the 13th. You know, I mean, it's a tragedy, but it'd be like kind of, you know, make it more spooky, you know?
Yeah.
I looked it up, and it was October 11th. So I was like, I think it was a Sunday is what I found out. It's like, dang. But it's still, you know, wild story, and it's going to work out good for Halloween because this is kind of, I mean, it's weird to say, but this is like a couple months out, this episode. So by the time this comes out, it'll be already out, but it's coming out this weekend. So
yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah, but thanks again for coming. And
we're going to
talk about Alta, I guess, or wherever you want to start, I guess.
Yeah, let's talk about Alta. So we're actually bringing a LiDAR machine to Alta next Monday. And so we're going to do a LiDAR scan of the cabin. And we're going to see kind of how this machine works because we're going to buy one for the region, Region 1 of the Forest Service here.
Oh, cool.
So we're going to test it out. And then Matt's actually going to Idaho to look at a cave to see how things work with the LiDAR.
Really?
With that particular type of resource versus a cabin. And then we'll make a decision about what we're going
to
buy.
Oh, cool. So that'd be nice to get take a little training run on it. Man.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be good. And so I figured we'd talk about Alta and we'd celebrate it a little bit, you know?
Yeah, it's such a cool spot. And I think it's, I don't know, I don't think that many people know about it. Because even I've been on the forest for forever, and I think I didn't find out about it until I did my detail to Trapper as a natural resource instructor.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, I was, like, looking for field trip ideas for the students, you know? I was like, hey, where should I go? And talking to a bunch of folks, like, well, I mean, Alta's a good one, and I should know what it is, and I should, because of its significance, you know, its historical significance, and I had no idea. And so I went and checked it out, and I don't think the door was wide open, but it wasn't locked, so I got to go inside and, like, look at it, and I was like, I'm surprised this isn't more, like, preserved, you know?
Yeah.
But there's reasons for that kind of, isn't there? I mean, like, because it was, well, I'll let you go. I'll start jumping the story at a weird time if I start talking.
No, it's okay.
Yeah. But yeah, so I got to check it out, and I guess I'll let you run through the history of it so I don't, like, muddy it up while I'm explaining my little experience with it, you know?
No, we can talk about your experience.
That's about all there was to it. I just kind of went out there in the winter and a really cold day and didn't spend too much time. Did, like, a lap around it and checked it out.
Yeah, it's not not like the Ritz, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in the winter, it's probably pretty cold in there.
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a pack right in there about the size of me, so I let him have his space. So.
Good. Well, I'm glad we've got a tenant, so that's exciting.
Yeah, someone keeping it.
Meet him and see what he's doing in there.
Yeah, making the place his own.
Yeah, I haven't seen any pack rats since the couple of times that we've been out there, but now I feel like I should go in the winter to meet Mr. Alta and see what he's up to.
Mr. Alta, that's a good name for him. Yeah, he was
that or Jerry, I'm not sure.
Oh, Jerry. Jerry just seems like a good pack rat name.
Yeah, it does.
It does, yeah. Yeah, I'd go with that for sure. Yeah, what if he's still kicking? I mean, they pulled like 8 pack rats out of the woodshed by Eastport Cabin this like last 2 weeks, I think, over 2 week period.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like, we went to go close. This is kind of a weird tangent before we get rolling, but we went to close Medicine Point Lookout, which is, have you been up there yet?
No, we haven't gone up there yet.
Oh, you got to check it out. It is awesome. The view is just amazing. You get to see so much of the forest, you know, from like one point, which is really cool, which is really hard to do in our forest because it's all the mountains, you know, so good to see a pretty good chunk. And, so anyways, on the way up, we were talking about that bear attack that they're calling a mega bear up by Big Sky. Yeah, Brandon. Brandon has actually been on the podcast once before. And so his episode will be on by the time this comes out. So it kind of works out. But Brandon's like, is everything just mega these days? You know, it's like the mega shark and all these mega things, you know?
Oh,
and
yeah.
I was like, I guess, man. But I guess it was a giant bear. So then, you know, jeez, a week later, he's trying to eradicate or what do you call it, like, evict these pack rats out of the woodshed there. And he's like we found the mega. And I was like, what? And he took a picture of it, and he's like, this giant pack rat. And I was like, oh, I think his cousin's living in Alta.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe he was just like in there for a minute. Like, he didn't look like he had a nest or anything in Alta. It's just like we just probably were visiting at the same time, you know.
We can only hope. But I feel like I should go see if Jerry's inhabiting Alta.
Yeah, Jerry's making himself comfortable.
Yeah, I didn't see him. It's like we try to go May, June, July, August, and then September. So, like, every month, because it is a visible cabin.
Yeah.
So we're always over there, like, what's happening. And
yeah,
I've
totally.
Yet to see him, so maybe I'm just not visiting on the right days, or maybe he's, like, a winter occupant.
Oh, it could be, yeah, because I was going to say, and since you haven't seen him, and you've been there more recent than I have, like, yeah, maybe he just kind of shows up on really cold days and then takes off back into wherever he lives.
Hopefully.
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully he doesn't live there.
I hope not either. Yeah, he doesn't need to. He's got plenty of forest he can have, you know?
Yeah.
He doesn't need to be taking the what is it, the original? The very first?
Yeah.
I'll just take it from there, I guess.
Oh, well, so Alta is the oldest standing structure that's associated with the Forest Service in the country.
Wow.
So
that's pretty cool. Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah. So it was constructed in 1899 by Than Wilkerson and Hank Tuttle. And they used their personal funds to buy all of the materials to construct it. And then Pete Bennett, he was a miner who kind of had a cabin there and a mining claim. He actually let them use his horses to kind of bring the logs and logging materials down to construct Alta.
Oh, cool.
Which is pretty cool because, I mean, there were no roads or anything like that at this time. So
they're
kind of paving the way.
Yeah, for folks who don't know or folks who do know, it is out there. I mean, it's kind of by Painted Rocks Reservoir, and even like today's standard with paved road all the way there, right? I mean, pretty much until you turn off to get there, right? I think it's all paved, and it's still, I mean, it's a cruise, you know? And then back then, by all horseback, is it, what year did you say it was?
1899.
Yeah, so I don't know when the first like motorized vehicle was, but I don't know if they were using them, you know?
Oh, might have been a little earlier than when they had them over here, at least in the forest.
So. Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially for the Forest Service, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and probably not reliable enough for the Forest Service to want to use them back then, you know, I imagine. Yeah. I don't know. Just saying things now.
Well, so they constructed this cabin in 1899, and that's about 2 years after the Bitterroot Reserve is created, which is in 1897. So about 1907, the Forest Service kind of begins to kind of shrink down the forest reserves and create national forests.
Oh.
So they're all converted over, and then they kind of change their boundaries, but the Bitterroot kind of stays more or less the same in that area. And so Tuttle and Wilkerson flew a 45-star flag, because at the time, there were only 45 states in the country.
45. Let me run this through in my brain real quick. So I know like Alaska wasn't until like was 60, because I know like one of my uncles, his mom was trying to get him to go to Alaska during Vietnam because it still wasn't a state at that point. It was just a territory.
Right.
So it was really recent. So Alaska wasn't there. Hawaii wasn't there yet.
No.
I'm trying to think who else would. What other states are like 45 star flag? You said.
Yeah.
Man, what is, what's left, I guess? I wouldn't even really know. Do you know?
Not off the top of my head.
No. Well, that's good, though. I mean, a little something for folks to look up on their own, because I know I'm going to look it up after this.
Yeah.
Man,
it's really interesting, right?
Yeah.
It's like, even today, we still fly a 45-star flag at Alta from May to September. It's about Memorial Day to Labor Day is when we fly that flag.
Really?
Yeah.
That's super cool. Man, that's cool tradition. I love those kind of things. That's why I love like talking to you, just like all this stuff. I mean, that McGruder one's amazing. Can't wait for people to hear that one. But
yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great podcast. Like the timeline, I mean, you nailed the story. Like you told it so great too. So
thanks.
Yeah, it was awesome. And then now this, like that Alta, holy cow. Like, I mean, I knew I was going to learn a bunch today because I always do when we're talking, but holy cow. That's really cool. I'm glad it sticks on. Did you have to order a flag? How'd you find it?
So they do sell like American flags with specific star patterns
because
different historic properties throughout the country will also kind of do the same thing.
That kind of makes sense. Like some of the original colonies probably have more like the circle of stars or whatever the
right. The old school and ones, right? It's more for like an educational purpose of like, oh, like this is the time period of when this was kind of constructed or when it's being utilized in the specific type of era that we're discussing.
Yeah, can you imagine being like a teacher and showing up there and being like, hey kids, you know anything different and notice anything different about this flag? You know, that's a good little like brain teaser to make the kids think like, wow, that's wild. And then, you know, I know if I was a kid, I'd run home and tell my folks like, hey, did you know about this? You know?
Yeah, because I mean, most of us have grown up with, you know, the flag the way it is, with all the stars and all the stripes. So it's really fascinating to see the different variations and why there's different variations, and to kind of learn that history.
Yeah, that's so cool. And that you guys keep it going. That's really cool.
Yeah, we try.
Yeah, no, it's the little things for me, you know.
Yeah. Well, we try to keep it authentic here on the B-Route, so.
Yeah, on the old B-Route. Oh, it's funny, like, when people first got here, they're, like, on the root, you know, like, because, like, some of the local folks are saying the root, you know, so.
Well, and when it was a forest reserve, it was Bitter Space Root.
Oh.
So that's kind of why.
Oh, yeah, sir, back then, yeah. Now it's, like, one word, and I'm always self-conscious about my spelling when I spell it. Like, two R's, two O's, two T's.
That's true. Yeah. It's, like, double everything in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm always like second guessing myself when I spell it out. Usually nail it, but you know, enough bragging.
Well, so Alta actually served as the official Bitterroot National Forest Ranger Station until about 1904. When it was discovered that the land beneath Alta actually belonged to Pete Bennett. It was part of his mining claim. So it was in private hands until about 1941, when it was purchased by the Hamilton Lions Club, and they donated it to the Bitterroot after they purchased it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So can I pass around some hands there for a minute?
Yeah, so it kind of hung out for a little while, and then it came back into the fold.
Yeah.
So...
That's really cool. I wonder where those fellows, the first fellows who built it, wonder where they got their hardware. You know, like, I just like it.
Grantsdale.
Oh, Grantsdale. How far is that from there?
Quite a ways.
That's what I was kind of thinking, man. What a trip, because to get, what was it, like, hinges and nails? Is that what they were getting, or?
Yeah. So they would have used nails, and then they used local trees in the area.
Yeah. To make the structure, right, the cabin? Yeah. Man. Because I'm thinking, I don't know how many nails, because it's a really small building for folks who don't know. It's worth looking up and putting the old Instagram. Oh, yeah, you got it. Oh, hey,
like
look at that.
Like little photos.
Yeah, you can kind of show it. People can kind of pick it up. There might be a little bit of a glare, but.
It's okay. Well, we can't take them out as a screen protector because they're special photos.
Oh, yeah, you don't want to damage those suckers. But you can see it's got you call it like a sod roof or a dirt roof or something?
Yeah, it's got a sod roof, and then it's got grass on top, which is really fascinating. And then you can see, like, the daubing, so the white in between the logs there.
Oh, yeah.
Just, like, really a characteristic of that time period. And you can see the side notching.
Oh, yeah.
On the sides of the cabin where the logs, like, intermingle.
Man. Shit.
Yeah.
I don't know how we would have done it, but I was going to say, we should have maybe done the podcast out there. It's so far out, though. It would have been like,
it
would have been a plan. It would have been like a Saturday podcast, not a, you know, after work podcast.
It's a long drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I actually have the original, well, a copy of the original blueprint for it.
Whoa.
The plan.
That is cool. So
it's really cool.
Yeah, when you're talking about the notched logs here, that's there in the corner, hey?
Yeah.
Whoa, that's cool. You can kind of see that for folks just watch on YouTube. You can kind of see the little grassy sod roof there. And man. And that's what I was kind of talking about. I mean, like, four windows probably, looks like, from what I can tell from this drawing, right?
Yeah, they only have four windows and then the door. So one on each side.
Yeah. Also, yeah. One, two, three. Yeah, four. Yeah. I didn't trust my math. And I didn't trust you. I'm sorry. I apologize. yeah, super cool. So super tiny. So I'm just thinking, like, hardware-wise. I mean, like, I don't know, three hinges or, you know, probably a typical door, and then maybe a door handle and some nails or, I mean, and maybe, I guess they probably had to get the material to make the daubing, maybe? I heard that's probably natural, something they could...
Yeah, they did get some type of material to kind of fix it.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, thanks for bringing that.
Yeah. I love to show off the blueprint, because, I mean, how often do you have a blueprint of one of the oldest buildings associated with the Forest Service?
So. Yeah. I mean, how lucky are we? Like, when I started this podcast, I think we talked about it in the last one, but, like, I knew it was, I mean, every forest has its own significance, you know, historical, but, I mean, the stuff that we have on this forest is bananas, and I keep finding, like, every month it seems like something new pops up, like,
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Like this, and then, that one map that we printed out that had all the sites for, at one point, that were lookouts, right? And
right.
That is so cool. And they're way more than I expected, like a ton out there. I was going to try to display it, but you wouldn't be able to see it. You know, like there's no way to, like,
there's too many.
Yeah. And it would just look like a blotch, you know, up here. So
it was the same with the ranger stations and the guard stations.
Oh, really?
They did the same thing. So they actually would plan out to have a ranger station in like each section of each range and township.
It's like a square.
PLSS. Yeah.
Yeah, like a square mile, right? Isn't it? I think a township. I think each section's a square mile, I think, if I'm right.
About so, yeah.
Yeah, that's wild. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. So you would have one in each, like, legal location, is what we call it today.
Yeah,
but they didn't end up building all of them, we don't think, because we haven't found remains in each spot where we're thinking, according to the map, the historic maps that they recorded these on, they should have been. So.
Dang. Man, that's still cool, though. I mean, like, just have that kind of planning. It makes sense, you know, if you're only at one horsepower, you know, riding horse rounds everywhere. Yeah. It's going to take a while.
Yeah, and you've got, like, a limited, you know, amount of employees, too.
Oh, true.
So.
Yeah, and supplies and stuff, you know. Yeah. Like, yeah, it'd be kind of hard to go too far out. And, yeah, like, there's a fellow named Smoke Elser. He's got a PBS special about him. He's one of my friend's grandpa, actually, and... I want to have him on, but he grew up just in the, like, right out of college, I think. Maybe he went to the Bob and just, like, spent most of his life there, and so they did a special on packing, you know, and his special is called 3 miles an hour, I think, because that's about the pace of a horse when the horse is, you know, walking. So that puts it in perspective for me. It's like, it makes sense to have that many buildings, because if you're only going 3 miles an hour, you know, because you can't, you know, it's not like the movies. It's not like the movies where you can just go to mad sprint everywhere on a horse, you know.
No, and the horse would get so tired. And especially if you're packing and you're bringing supplies in and out to different stations, I mean, that's a lot of weight for the horse or the mule to carry.
Yeah, totally.
You don't want to tire them out too much, because then you're screwed.
You're screwed. That's your lifeline. Yeah, you lose one of those. That could be a lot of your supplies just there, because you can't do anything if the mule or whatever keels over, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But so Alta is just a one-story log cabin, and it's about 13 by 15 feet. And it's actually became the model for how other ranger stations would be constructed, not just like across the Bitterroot, but across the country.
Whoa.
And most log cabins of this size were constructed on a foundation of native stone to kind of prevent the soils from kind of getting into the logs and making them deteriorate faster. So you would put it on like a stone foundation to kind of prevent that from happening too much.
Keep it dry, right? Yeah.
And so they used sod, which was not a popular technique on the roof.
That'd probably be some work to get that much.
Of work when we redid it in 1998.
Oh, wow.
A lot of work to kind of get the right angle and the right kind of mechanism to set up the sod roof. It took quite a while to figure out what was going to be the best and most authentic way.
Yeah. Probably got to worry about like weight distribution too, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then also, and then it's got to do its job, right? Keep water out, so.
Right.
Man, that's a lot. I would have loved to have been around for that.
Well, it is pretty cool, and you can see inside the cabin, those who worked on it actually signed a non-historic plank, so it's a pretty recent plank that they just added in there, and they all wrote their names on it.
Oh, cool.
Man. Yeah.
That'd be really cool to be a part of, you know?
Yeah, I mean, inside the cabin, you can see tons of historic graffiti.
Oh, really?
So people would go in, write their names. Dan, his name is in there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It's an interesting spot.
Yeah, I'll have to run up there. I was planning on making a trip up there this fall, so I might have to run up there with my old trusty Land Cruiser and go take a look.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah.
Definitely look. Left side of the cabin, there's a ton of graffiti. So just names, dates. It's really interesting.
That's so cool.
It's one of my favorite parts of the cabin.
Yeah, you could have one of the best jobs in the world, I think. You know, that's so cool, like all the stuff that you get to do, you know?
Yeah. I'm jealous of myself sometimes.
Yeah. No, I don't blame you. Jeez. You're going to have a bunch of people besides, you know, like me and you jealous of what you get to do. You know? Like, imagine a bunch of other archaeologists that are, you know, really into the forest, or is probably, you know, are a little envious as well. Just, I mean, the original structure, all the lookouts. I mean, we've got a lot going on. And
we've got a ton.
And then all the native artifacts and stuff, too. And
yeah.
And, like, I think we talked about the last time that it's weird because, like, in some parts of the world, it feels like everything's found already, but it seems like, talking to you, it seems like there's still stuff that is getting found. And
nothing's ever totally found. If there's one thing anybody takes away from anything that I say on any episodes we do for the podcast, it's that nothing is 100% completely found.
Oh, awesome.
There's still history to be discovered, to be learned, to be discussed in every part of the world, in every region.
Yeah.
Even if it's just a different point of view for the discussion and a different interpretation of a site that's currently being worked on or was worked on in the past.
That's a good point. So, and then the new technology like the LiDAR, it kind of goes full circle with what we started talking about.
Yeah,
because then you get more technology and kind of dig a little deeper. Because the LiDAR, it goes kind of through material, right? So.
Right. So a LiDAR is really helpful in areas where you have a high concentration of vegetation. It's also really helpful for kind of looking at rock shelters and kind of getting an idea of a 3D model and looking at pictographs and petroglyphs, or looking at historic structures and kind of recording these things for the future.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And then let me take a stab at this petroglyph. Pictograph is like a picture drawn on the wall.
Right, it's a painting.
Painting,
and then
yeah.
The petroglyph is more of a carving.
Oh, gotcha.
So up here, at least on the route, we mostly have pictographs. So they're all paintings.
Oh.
We don't have a whole lot. We have some.
Yeah.
But
one of our friends is always on the hunt.
Yeah.
He cracks me up, old Jared.
Yeah.
Like, that's all he's talking about when I told him about us, getting together for the Magruder podcast. And he was trying to fleece me for information. He's like, what'd you find out? He's like, it's like, man, nothing. Because I didn't know what he was asking about, So, and I won't give up. I don't want to give too much away here. But leave it a mystery, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
But I like that about your job, too. Like, the mystery and then finding out new things. And, through your whole career with technology and whatever else, you'll probably be re-examining things that, were already kind of put to bed in, a cold file. And then being like, well, we got this now, so let's go check that out again.
Well, it's always the case. Nothing's ever cold file. It's very seldom case closed for us. I think there's always something that pops up that makes us kind of re-explore everything we thought before.
Yeah.
So that's what makes it exciting, though.
Totally. Yeah.
It's never the same.
Yeah, because I imagine, too, you find something off the Nez Perce Trail or something, and you're like, wait a minute, that looked kind of similar to something else we were looking at before, So you go re-examine that and get some more answers maybe.
Well, and that happened this summer. We actually had, we actually went to a couple of the ranger districts and decided to do a talk about what it is we do.
Yeah.
Because not everyone kind of knows what archaeologists who are working in a federal agency are kind of responsible for and what kind of work they're doing.
Yeah.
There is a huge disconnect in the public between archaeologists and being, paleontologists and digging up dinosaurs.
True.
Or, doing the whole Indiana Jones running from things.
Yeah.
But we don't necessarily do either of those.
No.
So it's good for us to get out and talk about it. And after we gave this talk, about a month or two later, I actually got a phone call from one of, so we gave it to the firefighters and seasonals that were working in that district.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're going to be doing a lot of project work in areas that we might not necessarily get to, because we have kind of a site identification strategy or survey identification strategy of how we determine where we're going to go to survey, just because there's so much to cover.
Yeah.
So kind of try to think where is the highest to medium probability of, archaeological sites and use of this landscape, where there are low probabilities. Like, what are we looking for specifically and different stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
dang.
They actually found this really cool rock, and it looks like it's probably a survey marker from when they were surveying back with USGS in the late 1890s.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Man, that's cool. Yeah, that's a good point. Like, that's really smart going out and just telling the folks, typically fire folks are in the field more. Occasionally timber, timber puts a lot of miles on, but...
Oh, yeah. We've talked to timber, fire. My goal is this next spring to kind of go out to every ranger district and do the same type of program, because we ended up going out to a site as well.
Oh, cool.
Kind of looking at it. And it was a site that was not eligible. It was a post-contact site. So probably was an old homestead. And so we got to look at some trash and kind of look at fire suppression efforts that had been instigated around the site because it was previously unevaluated. So, yeah. And that kind of helps them understand, too, like, why we're asking for one hand line to be dug in a specific location or why you might have to change your location of your hand line.
Yeah.
At the last minute. Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's happened to us a few times. But, like, every fire I've been on where, you know, like, out in eastern Montana or wherever, like, a big fire that an arc came out and was like, hey, and sometimes they didn't really know. They just, like, the fire went here and something came up and, like, oh wow, we got the dozer was coming through, you know, like, hey, can we avoid this? And, like, oh, absolutely. Not a big deal. It just sucks when, like, it already happens and you uncover something, you're like, dang, you know, because no one knew about it, you know, and you're like, oh.
Right. And sometimes it can be a little bit slower to relay the information. So it's easier just to let everybody know kind of the reasons behind why we're asking for the hand line to be moved or why, you know, we're asking for the dozer not to go through the site boundary.
Yeah.
Because then, I mean, it's a lot easier to explain why than just say no.
Yeah, yeah, totally, yeah, because, like, I mean, no one likes to just, like, everyone wants to know the why, like, I mean, because especially when you're, you know, trying to put out a fire, like, wait, like, from me to that point, the straight line is the best, and we're going to get, you know, this, and it's flat or whatever it might be, but if I have to go all the way out here or, you know, whatever you got to do, and then, but if you find out, like, something historical is there, you're like, oh, all right, yeah, we'll make that work, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, not a big deal.
We try to, like, relay the information appropriately.
Yeah.
So for some pre-contact sites, we might not disclose, like, the specific location. We might have a larger buffer around it. Just because that's a sacred site and we've been asked by our tribal partners not to disclose information.
Yeah.
We'll also kind of talk to them about what type of suppression efforts they might want to see in those areas. And for the most part, you know, it's the natural cycle, introducing fire into the landscape.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, totally. Like, so, learning more recently about the Native Americans doing it themselves, you know, back in the day. So it's kind of cool. And that, I mean, the whole Forest Service is kind of cool, the way things are going, what we're getting more into the prescribed fire, and I think that's going to help in the future with, you know, the fuel loading and just the ecosystem, you know, the fire ecology of everything. So, yeah, it's cool. Well, I got to keep getting you derailed on the Alta thing. Might let you get back to that.
So Alta also has a V or steeple notch, and this is used to kind of ensure the stability of the log frame.
Oh.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, so like at the steeple, like at the top, or like just in each log's kind of...
Yeah, at the top, it's got a V steeple.
Oh, gotcha.
Which is really interesting. And let's see. So the dobbing, which we already talked about, that kind of better insulates the cabin.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not as cold for Jerry the pack rat.
Jerry the pack rat.
When he's in there.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
It's probably his place of choice there, yeah.
Yeah, I would think so. The insulation from the dobbing, he just loves it.
Yeah, gets him out of the wind for a while. Gets to hang out.
Gets dry from the snow and the rain.
Yeah, that could have been why he's in there, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a nasty day when I went in there.
I think that's what he was doing.
I think so, too. getting out of the elements. I don't blame him.
Yeah. So it's also like a pen-style build. So it's just a one-room, dirt floor cabin for sleeping, dining, and working.
Oh, wow.
So when they built this cabin, they would actually sit kind of in the corner. So they had, like, a little cot, and then they had a desk. And people would come in, and we actually have Than Wilkerson's journals in our archive collection, in our museum curation facility. And he would write down the people who came to visit him, members of the Salish tribe that were living in the area, members of the Dos Pierce tribe that were living in the area, different settlers that were working on mining claims or homesteading claims, and they were just coming by to talk to him about different things. And
man, what a cool idea, probably, you know, like just getting to talk to all these different folks. And you know, and probably, you know, I don't know exactly what his title was. Like, I mean, it sounds like he's just kind of like an information post, right?
Well, he was the ranger.
Oh, gotcha.
So he's the Alta ranger.
Oh, gotcha.
And at that time, it wasn't kind of developed into the West Fork, Darby, Sula, and Stevensville, and then Magruder. It was just
the Bitterroot.
Just the root.
Yeah, just the root. Yeah, because
the Bitterroot.
Yeah. Wow. So, and so, since he was kind of a... Was he the only person staffing there at the time?
Hank... Tuttle was also there.
Oh, that helped him build it.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
But he was the primary person that we kind of have records from.
Oh, gotcha.
So we kind of refer to him a lot.
Yeah. I wonder, I have no idea, and you might know better, but like just speculating, it seems like probably Dan was holding down the desk and maybe Hank was going out and doing some more of the field work maybe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they had 500,000 acres to survey and cover.
Could you imagine?
Yeah.
Oh, Hank, we'll see you next month. You know?
Basically.
Yeah. Take off for a month and come back.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I mean, they had a lot of priorities. I mean, you had to kind of figure out what the best timber production areas were going to be, how much timber you had.
Oh, yeah.
Different resources.
Yeah. Yeah, because the mills were probably going pretty good around Hamilton and starting to maybe, you know.
Yeah, and up into, or down into Darby as well.
Oh, yeah, 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 Darby, you know, known for the logging community there. Man.
Yeah, it wasn't always just Yellowstone.
No, yeah, it wasn't just a show, yeah.
No.
No, yeah, rich history there besides the ranching life. Man, that's cool. So Dan's seen all these folks. Imagine, like, you know, just out of curiosity, you think, working that post, you have a lot of questions for folks. So, like, the Salish or Nez Perce come through, he's probably like, hey, what do you know? You know, like, and I mean, that's what I'd be doing because, you know, talking to folks who grew up in the area, you know, like generationally, like the tribes, you know, and maybe getting some inside information on some things, you know.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even like, I'd be picking their brains about everything from like recipes to cool trails and, you know, like, what they prefer to eat, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of really interesting conversations and.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
that'd be so cool.
It would be a really great thesis topic.
Yeah. Man, if I had a little time machine, just go back and, like, sit down on the... I mean, it'd probably be slow days, so it'd probably be kind of weird, but, like, go and sit down on Alta for a while, you know, for, like, a month and see what comes through.
It would be nice.
Yeah.
It would be really interesting to see kind of what people say, too.
Yeah, yeah, the reports from, like, being out and in wherever, you know, and... Yeah. Yeah. That'd be super cool.
Yeah, it would.
So it's pen style, you said? Pen style built?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's where I derailed you.
No, it's okay. Yeah, so it's a pen style build, so it's kind of, it's just that one room dirt floor. Like, it's a small structure.
Oh, yeah.
I think maybe three people today, if you count my boss, because he's, like, 6 foot. I could probably fit in that building.
Yeah.
Across, so.
Talking about Matt?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Matt would have, he might have to go, like, diagonal. He's pretty tall.
I mean, he does kind of fit in, you know, vertically, so he's okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just like barely.
Yeah.
But it's good.
You have to take his cowboy boots off to go in.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's a pretty tall feller.
Yeah. But that's good because when we do kind of put the flag up in May and we take it down in September, he can do that really easily because he can reach the flagpole because it's so high.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. You need a tall guy. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Matt, yeah. He's awesome. I love that guy. I've known him so long, and it's wild that there was just like a break in our like friendship and from when he was in college and from when I was in college, I guess. And he's related to one of my best buddies. So, it was kind of cool to rekindle. And then, like, you know, just when you're just out and about, like, his buddies, like, going out to a brewery or whatever, you know, went to his house for Halloween. And, you get to just talking about like what's, you know, happened right then, you know, so you don't like, I think we talked a little bit about the Forest Service. Cause I think we were both in the Forest Service at the time and still are, but, so we're kind of, you know, we kind of scratched the surface, but like, I didn't know much about like what he'd been doing. And then, so I got catching up with him recently about like killed this afternoon, just asking a bunch of questions about like where he'd been, what he'd been up to and kind of the products that you guys are working on. Which are, as you know, I'm an enthusiast.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is amazing.
Yeah.
So
we appreciate it.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
Yeah, it's good information to get out there, especially because like when we started the podcast, when I was talking about not knowing about Alta until, you know, at Trapper, and then just looking for all those field trip opportunities for the students, you know, and like peel trees and lookouts and anything that I could go to help get the students out in the field and get to do some hands-on, you know, activities. So,
yeah. And I mean, we have some really amazing peel tree stands on this forest, like some of the biggest, best preserved in the world.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
So we're actually going to eventually nominate them to be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. So that it'll be hidden from the public because we have to protect these locations and the historic properties of these peel trees, but it'll be good to kind of get them, you know, their recognition and protection.
Yeah, totally, because then if it's registered, then if a fire does come through, it comes in the planning, right? To like, all
right,
we got to...
Right. Yeah. Well, as of right now, they would already come through the planning because they're eligible.
Oh,
but good. To list them, it would allow us to kind of give them a greater, I guess, not just protection, but greater...
I'm trying to think of security.
It's more of like just... status, if you will. A status. A greater status. So it'll be like a little more elite than the other eligible sites. Not that eligible isn't amazing, but...
Yeah, raises the bar up a little bit.
Right. So for the listed properties, we kind of celebrate them a little bit more.
Yeah, I like that, because I didn't know about them until the, you know, planned field trips. And everyone's like, yeah, go to, you know, these places. I don't want to say, because...
Right.
Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but for the students, go check them out and kind of do some research on them. And yeah. So back to Alta. So Hank and Dan were holding down the fort.
So Dan and Hank
yeah.
built the structure. Dan was the primary ranger, from what we can tell. Hank was doing a lot more of the field work. And then Dan, so they built the structure with no kind of information from, you know, Washington. It was just kind of a bare bones. This is what you're going to do. These are your priorities. Survey the land, figure out the timber, figure out the resources, like what's there, what's going on. This was not until about 1905 that the chief forester, Gifford Pinchot, publishes the use book, which kind of outlines the expectations of what a ranger station in a ranger's house will be. Because at that time, the ranger station was the ranger's house.
Oh, like, yeah. Yeah, you see the old photos like Sula and other ranger stations have been where, like, you'd see, like, the ranger and his family there, you know, living. And
it's the same at the West Fork in Magruder. You'll see photos up until the 60s of families living in these ranger stations and ranger houses. So
really jealous of those folks. That's so cool. Man.
It's really fascinating. I spoke to someone who lives in the valley. That actually lived in the ranger station.
Really?
Yeah, with their family. So,
man, what a cool deal that would be.
Yeah. And now that structure has been listed on the National Register, it's on the West Fork.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah. Man. We just listed it this July.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. Yeah,
congrats. That's awesome. Yeah.
It was my first listing. So hopefully the first of many.
Yeah, well, congrats. That's huge. That's a good start.
Yeah, it was a good, interesting experience. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you listed, did you have to run through some more information and make sure you had, like, all the stuff to the pertinent information for it to be listed?
Yeah. So we hired a contractor to prepare the National Register nomination form, which is a pretty extensive, robust review of the history and what you're kind of nominating. So the different measurements for the structures, because we did three, kind of, you know, if they had side notches, what the roof situation was, and they were all cedar shingle.
Oh, really? All cedar? Yeah.
Yeah.
Dang.
So then I went through, after we got that back, edited it, and then kind of prepared an additional site form. And then we had to kind of present on this to the state review board. So every state has a review board that determines whether or not they're going to push your nomination forward. So I worked with the Montana State Historic Preservation Office to kind of clean up our submission. And then we presented on it in May.
Oh.
It's my first time presenting in front of the board, so hopefully it wasn't that bad. But
no, yeah, you
did
great.
Get but it was listed, good. So.
Yes, yeah, so it worked out, you know.
Yeah, and so it was good. I'm very excited it's on the register now.
Yeah.
We're working towards doing some other nominations as well.
Oh, cool. That's really good. I mean, that's, to me, it's so important to preserve history as best we can, you know, and you can't get it all, but, like, the most we can, and I think it's awesome. I always get so sad when I see old structures that just get lost, and for some reason they don't get registered, and then, you know, they're never, you know, they're gone,
right.
And the next generations can't enjoy it. And you just have the stories of somebody, like, who's eventually going to be me for sure. Some old guy's like, there used to be this cool old cabin over here, you know?
Yeah.
And they're like, sure, Grandpa. And I'm like, no, it was awesome. I was there. <You know? laughs> But it'd be cool if they could have the same experience, you know? Like,
yeah.
The cabins we get to still use around the forest is pretty awesome.
Right, and we have quite a few. I think one of my favorites is the Hayward Lodge up in Como.
Oh.
It's beautiful. So Dr. Hayward actually constructed it in the late 30s into the early 40s. Oh. And it's a hexagonal shape, which is so fascinating. It's so fun. Like, yeah. You would do a hexagon in the middle of the building, and you've got kind of like rooms on wings. Either side. Yeah. It's exciting. And the deck is beautiful. We actually just had to do an emergency replacement. Because it had deteriorated significantly in the last couple of years. So we just did an emergency replacement so that the structure wasn't impacted by that.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah,
cause stabilize everything.
Yeah, I knew they were doing something, you know, talking to the rec folks. But because I was helping get the firewood there for folks to, you know, yeah. For the renters. And so
there's a ton of firewood.
Yeah, totally. I guess they need a ton more, is it? Yeah. They get go run through because the building is pretty big. So.
Well, I would say it's one of our most popular rec rentals, too, on the forest.
Totally makes sense. Cause like you said, you walk in. And I went there probably 2 months ago for the first time. And, like, as soon as you walk in, like, that hexagonal shape is just beautiful.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. And then they just refinished all the flooring, too, repainted. I think they're still finishing up a few finishing touches, but it looks amazing. Yeah. So.
Only downside is kind of that steep entry into the sucker, but, you know, when you drive in.
That's okay. That's part of the fun.
Yeah, makes you earn it a little bit, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's like a little bit of a roller coaster, you know? Like, it is. And then you hit the building and, well, not hopefully with your car, hit, but
I'm sure some people have gotten close.
I hope not.
Yeah, just because, you know, the people use it in the winter and stuff, I think, too, right? But the view is awesome coming off the hill because then you're looking down, like you said, at the cabin, and then Como's behind it.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah.
Really, really cool.
And that's one of only two cabins that are on Como.
Oh, yeah, because the other one's like right next door, right?
The Hikers Club Lodge, yeah.
Yeah.
They've done a spectacular job maintaining that structure. I mean, really fabulous.
Yeah, so, yeah, for sure. Because, the first time seeing that either. It looked great. I didn't know really what it was until, you know, because I got there a little before the wreck fell, and I just went and walked that trail. And
oh, okay.
I was like, man, that's a cool cab. And then he, you know, filled me in on that it was the Hikers folks that were using it.
Yeah, they have a permit, so that's their cabin, but... I mean, they've done a spectacular job keeping it up to date and in great condition.
Yeah, it looks awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing a great job.
They are.
So, get for Pincho. What year was that again? That's where I kind of derailed you. I'm trying to bookmark it in my brain when we go off on another tangent. So.
1905 is when he publishes that use book. So that kind of discusses kind of how you're going to go about building your ranger station and kind of the expectations, because you're expected to keep it very clean. You're expected to, you know, keep it professional, even though you're living and working in the same building.
Yeah.
And in Alta's case, it's the same room.
So that makes it
a bit more important, right?
Yeah, definitely got to keep it clean. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tidy. Man, that'd be hard.
Yeah, it's a little difficult, but it isn't really until after World War I that we see kind of more streamlined designs that are coming out of the regional offices. And each region of the Forest Service is different for what your structure should look like.
Oh, really?
So in the Southwest, they represent Southwestern environments. Oh. So they have more of the adobe shape. Whereas in the Northwest, it's the log cabin. And so it's meant to kind of blend in with the area that you're working in.
Man, I like that. I feel like we got away from that recently. Like, you know, look at the big offices and they're not...
Yeah.
They don't speak Forest Service to me, and it's just, you know, convenience, I guess. You know, a lot of them are rentals, just rent from whoever's got a big building in town, you know, like the Hamilton SO, and I think the Butte office too for the Butte Jefferson District is, I think, a rental. So it's like, it sucks because you get more of a real bland, you know, sometimes 90s, you know, built building that doesn't really, to me, doesn't speak Forest Service, you know, or doesn't have the vibe of it, you know.
Right. And that kind of came about with, you know, kind of reducing the number of structures that were, you know, either owned or administered by agencies and kind of, because you had less of a workforce and then people were trying to reduce kind of the amount of costs that were going into structural, I guess, upkeep and usage.
Yeah, consolidate everything. Yeah, it makes sense. Right. Yeah. Man, it's a shame, though, because I think all of our offices should still look like cabins, you know?
It would be nice.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's why we're here, like, for that kind of more cabin life, outdoor lifestyle, you know?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, Ulta's always available.
That is true. So. Yeah, just go, you know, shack up with Jerry for an evening and bring, bring a couple crackers for him so he doesn't bug me.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll shoo him out for the evening.
Yeah, and tell him to go home. Like, he can't hang out there all night. Yeah, you know, it's,
you can visit, but yeah, this isn't your place to live.
You can visit, you know, tour the area, but it's time to go,
yeah,
Jerry.
No overnight, no overnight camping here, Jerry.
Yeah, no, it's not permitted.
Yeah, exactly. Man. So then World War II, was Alta doing anything? Were they doing anything with Alta after?
Cause no, so it was still in private hands from about 1904 until 1941 when the Hamilton Lions Club bought it. But in between that period, so specifically in the 20s, late 20s, and then really more predominantly into the 30s, you had Clyde Fix, who was developing plans for lookouts, and then you also had ranger stations and guard stations that were coming out of the regional office. Uh-huh. So these were more streamlined, like, examples, blueprints of what you should be building in this particular region of the Forest Service for this particular type of building.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. So Alta predates all that. I mean, there was really no rule book when they constructed this structure, so they just did what they could do.
Yeah.
Which was pretty amazing because it's still standing.
It is amazing, yeah. Especially knowing to do that, what do you call it, like foundation, you know, to keep the logs off the ground so they don't rot. Like, that's
right.
A really good idea. Man. So, wait, who bought it again in 40?
The Hamilton Lions Club.
Lions Club, yeah.
Bought it in 1941, and then they donated it to the Root.
Oh, cool.
So, to the Root. I'm pretty grateful.
Yeah. Was it just like that little, like, kind of lot it sits on, or was it like...
Yeah, it was just the small lot with Alta.
Oh, gotcha.
It's an extremely important piece of history, so we're very grateful that they chose to donate it to us.
Yeah, thank you, Hamilton Lions Club.
Yeah, I know.
That was a great move for them and for us. I mean, well, for us, but really great move on their part. Appreciate them.
Yeah, and so now the cabin will be preserved, and it's listed on the National Register. It was actually the first historic property that we ever listed on the National Register.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We listed it in December of 1974, so it was really early.
Right.
I mean, the National Historic Preservation Act was passed in 1966, and then other laws for federal historic preservation, including the one that kind of gives us the blueprint for the National Register, it was quite early.
Dang, yeah, that's awesome. I didn't know. Yeah, because like your register in the West Fork. Am I seeing that right? The register
you just did?
The listing, yeah. Like, during just my time in the Forest Service, it seems like more, that's what I'm more used to, is like stuff that's kind of like, you get identified as historic, and then, you know, you come along and you get it registered. And so, I mean, something going all the way back to 74. That's 74, you said, right?
74, yeah. Yeah, so it's the oldest one that we have. So other places probably have older listings, but
probably not by much, though, right? Because if it 66 was when they passed the act, as you said, the act.
The NHPA, and then the National Register is kind of intertwined with other federal historic preservation laws that have been passed.
Man,
so
yeah.
There's a whole book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There's probably a lot to know, and do you know quite a bit of it then?
A little bit. I'm still learning, definitely, but
yeah. Matt could probably tell you chapter and verse and
no.
No?
he probably could.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna think. I don't know. Yeah. He's got a bunch of stuff going down, so I mean, but he's got a big brain, so
yeah.
Gets it all good. Well, same with you too, so
no, thanks.
I feel like I'm, you know, struggling to keep up with you, but trying to keep the dates sorted in my brain. So Lions Club in 1941?
Yes.
And then Does anything happen after that, or what happens after that?
So we actually repaired it and rehabilitated it. So in 1998, a tree actually fell on it, and then the roof had been replaced.
Oh.
And they just put planks on top. So in 98, we went back. We fixed the side of the cabin that had been damaged by the tree, and then we repaired the sod roof, so we added it back. And I think we did some more work on the roof a couple of years later.
Oh, man.
As well.
So that's a tough little sturdy structure. I mean,
yeah.
Takes a tree and, I mean, still, I mean, like from, so 1904 is last year that they were using it, right?
Right. So it sat, I mean, it could have been used by people who were living there too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because, you know, for it to like stay up from 1904 to 1941, I mean, that's, That's a long time, you know. Yeah. Almost 40 years, a little shy of 40 years for a structure just to be sitting there without maintenance and unattended. So, I bet the miners and whoever else was probably keeping it up, huh?
Yeah, I think probably using it. I mean, sitting on your land, why not? Yeah. It's a structure you don't have to build. I'd probably use it too.
Yeah, totally, yeah, for storage or whatever, you know, and maybe just like a place to hang, you know?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's not a bad spot.
Oh, yeah, beautiful. Close to the reservoir there. Probably wasn't a reservoir back then, but...
No, it would have been kind of just that...
creek.
Creek, yeah.
What is a creek? Do you know? Off the top of your head?
I thought it was slated rock.
Oh, that makes sense, because Slate Rock, Point Lookout's right above it, so...
Right.
Have you been there?
I have, yeah.
Oh, cool.
And then there used to be a ranger station supposedly there, too. What? But now it's inundated by the reservoir. You can kind of see... when it's at its low levels, like now, you can kind of see the footprint of the old ranger station. But
oh, wow. Wait, are the rednecks running through with their mud rigs?
Probably.
Yeah, like when I found out that they could do it, because at first I thought it was just a bunch of wild, you know, country boys just having a few too many road sodas and ripping through the reservoir. But then I heard that it's okay. I was like, man, seems like it could be kind of hard on vehicles with all those stumps, but...
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it.
No, I wouldn't, yeah. I don't.
As you want.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Whatever floats your boat, you know, and get you out in the country. But yeah, it seems like a dangerous game, an expensive game if you zig when you should zag, you know?
That's true.
You catch a tire or an axle on one of those big old stumps.
Yikes. But
yeah. Man, so 41, they give it back to us that first year, 41?
It took a little bit of time to go through all the paperwork. Oh. There's a process for donating things.
Oh, gotcha. So,
yeah.
That's cool. And then...
Yeah.
And then, 98, I guess, last time. Did I skip anything in between?
No. That's kind of all we have in our file that we wanted to talk about. So.
No, that's cool. Yeah. Yeah. There's probably more. And then with the LIDAR, you guys probably find some more stuff. And
yeah, I'm hopeful that even with the LIDAR, we'll be able to pick up some of those really faint historic graffiti that we have, like the names and the years.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. I didn't think about that. That'd be really cool. You know, like you hear about, like Lewis and Clark, like Pompey's Pillar, Pompey's, you know, have you been? I think it's called Pompey's Pillar, but some people call it Pompey's.
Yeah.
But Clark has his name carved in the pillar there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's probably quite a bit of that with a LIDAR you probably could find, huh?
Yeah, I'm excited. We have some really faint names and dates that I'm hoping we'll get a better read on.
Oh, yeah.
So I can tell us, too, kind of like when people were visiting, who was visiting, who was using the structure.
Yeah, especially you got like a full name there or something, huh?
Yeah, that's
really interesting. Man, that's cool.
Yeah, so stay tuned.
Yeah, we'll have more feedback. Is that going to be this summer project? I'm just checking the clock. I don't want to keep you too long.
It might be. So we'll be doing the LIDAR next Monday. Research probably do this summer. Probably not. Probably next fall.
Oh, gotcha.
Summer is our field season. Yeah,
busy, huh?
All the field work, all the surveys, condition assessments.
And there's only four of you out in Matt, right?
We have three.
Yeah.
Matt, Kyle, and I. And then we have an archaeologist who works with us in a partnership at part-time at the moment. And that's it. And we'll see. We're looking to hire two... additional archaeologists.
So shout out to anybody looking.
Well, the job did fly. They're currently going through the interview process. So
Well, good luck to the applicants, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hopefully get some good ones. That'd be awesome. Yeah,
hopefully we get some people who are interested.
Yeah.
And it can be hard to compete with all the other forests in Region 1 and Region 4.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, Region 4 is right there. I didn't even think about that, man.
Well, we all flew jobs at the same time in kind of similar positions, so. Yeah.
Yeah. Dang, that'd be tough. It'd be tough, you know, because, like, before, you just kind of took whatever you get, like, you know, a couple of years ago, when you're first getting out of school, but if you have some options, that might make it a little harder, because I imagine if I was in your field, I'd be doing some research for it, I'd be applying, and it would be really hard. Like, I guess someone would speak to you, right? Like,
right.
Whether it was like Alta or Magruder, all that stuff, you know. Did I cut you off anything that you were...
No, I think we covered everything for Alta.
For so. Alta? Oh,
for right now.
Yeah, for right now. So, yeah, like I said, stay tuned for that.
Yeah.
And we're about 55 minutes in, so I don't know if you want to...
We could talk about job opportunities since we kind of brought up
that's we're good. Hiring. Yeah, hey, good segue. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. So, yeah, like when you're first coming out of school, sometimes you don't really get to be picky. It can be really difficult to get your foot in the door for a federal position in archaeology, cultural resource management, so history, museum curation, museum specialist, anthropologist, including physical anthropologist, archivist.
Jeez.
There's tons of different branches you can choose from, and it can be difficult.
I had no idea. Like, I've heard all those words before, but I didn't know that it was that fast, you know?
Yeah. And we're all under cultural resource management for the most part. We all work together.
Yeah, that's cool. And having all that going on, you kind of have a little flexibility in the field, right? So if you want to do, is it like... Can you resource about what do you go on a fire as an archaeologist? Or is it like a read?
I do. So I have my, I'm actually now after this summer, a qualified resource advisor on the fire line.
Congrats.
Surprisingly. Thank you.
That's good though. That's cool. That's
no longer a trainee, but always learning.
Yeah, always learning. That's key though. That's huge.
It's true.
Yeah.
So archaeologists can go out as reeds or reefs, as they're calling them now, but only archaeologists can be fire archaeologists. So essentially, if a dozer does go through kind of an area and there's a lithic scatter, a fire archaeologist will respond, but we have to have a card, like a red card,
to
do that.
Yeah, that makes
so
sense.
That was important for me coming on to like make sure that I had a red card so that I could respond if we do have a crisis. Like, Alta was actually wrapped during the fires of 2000. It was in danger. We had some of the lookouts that are now listed that were wrapped.
Oh, yeah.
Jeez. So.
Yeah, that was crazy fire. And I didn't think of Alta was probably like in the teeth of that sucker, you know?
Yeah. Man, right there.
Yeah, like the narrow. It's so crazy talking to folks who were around that time. Like, I talked to friends. I had friends that worked, like, just even here in Stevensville and then working down, like, in Salmon area. And how narrow that band of electricity that came through that just hammered the Bitter and just that West Fork to Darby Sula band. And
it was insane.
Insane, yeah. One of the lookouts was telling me that each lightning bolt they saw, like, split, and each fork started a new fire.
Jeez.
Like, yeah, just crazy conditions. Like, that's the most electrical activity that they'd ever seen. And, you know, being a lookout, I think that fella in particular, like, 50 years of experience in the lookout and had never seen anything like that. So
it was a crazy fire season, but I mean, fingers crossed we don't have that happen again, but just in case, it's always good to have your card in case you got to run out.
I was gonna say, now you're ready. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm prepared.
yeah, because we talked about grad school a little bit. I don't know if it was on the podcast, but because you did it, was it last year or 2 years ago?
I did it last September at Trapper Job Corps, actually.
Yeah.
And so I've actually been trying to go every grad school that they've had to talk to the students about cultural resource management, reeds, reefs. We're not that scary, you know.
Yeah.
We're cool, too.
Yeah, we're cool, too. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. You guys are cool.
So just to kind of give them an idea of, like, why we're asking people not to, you know, dozer through a lithic scatter.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, don't get mad. It's just
slightly important.
Yeah. Sort of sense some significance there, you know?
Right. And kind of just explain, like, why we're asking, you know, the duff around a peel tree to be scraped back.
Yeah.
And to, you know, protect that resource to prevent the tree from, you know, getting smoke inhalation and dying. We want to make sure that we're doing our best to protect these structures. Why we might ask you to wrap Alta a specific way.
Yeah.
Might not make sense to someone who isn't doing preservation work.
Yeah.
So, but it is important. Yeah. We're not just nerds.
No, not at all. And you guys really care about it. You know, we're all the same thing. You know, we're all trying to preserve the forest and the forest resources and this, you know, history. The historic structures fit right in there too, because they tell their own story about, like, just Alta alone. When we first started talking out, like, you know, those two fellows, Hank and Dan, right? Hank and Dan just holding it down there in the middle of nowhere, you know, so that just that. Alta is like a beacon for that and for what they did, you know.
And after they kind of established the ranger station, actually the mining town of Alta grew up around that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's actually there was an old post office and a guard station that was constructed actually on forest property.
Whoa, I never knew that. That's cool.
Yeah, and there's like tons of different activities that were going on over there.
So. Man, that's cool. Yeah, it was a little bustling little area for a little while. Yeah. That'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, it had its own little boom.
Yeah, a little boom. Yeah, that's kind of what I was looking for. Yeah, that's really cool. And there's a ton of that, especially out west, it feels like. You know, these little booms that happen, whether it was like mining or timber probably, or even the railroad. Time. You know, have you done the Hiawatha Trail?
No, I haven't.
That one's pretty interesting. I think, especially you being an archaeologist, I think you'd really dig it because some of those little communities that popped up just because of the railroad, like they wouldn't have really been there, you know.
And for like housing for the workers.
Yeah, and I think I want to say a few of those little communities that you bike past, there's only way to get there was by train. Like there was no road. So just this little community off the rail stop, which is really neat, you know, in the mountains. Super cool. Yeah, so, yeah, folks, I guess, do you have any more to talk about?
Well, I guess, like, for the careers.
Yeah, careers, that's what I was trying to get at. I'm like, what? I almost said curation, but I was like, what? There's some other C word I was looking for.
Yeah, I guess it can be difficult when you're first out of school. Definitely research kind of areas where you are interested in working. Every area has a really unique and fascinating history.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's always something fun and exciting to learn.
Is it overwhelming when you first come out of school? Because, you know, being like boots on the ground and doing a little more hands-on?
It wasn't necessarily for me because I had been doing it during school.
Oh, yeah.
But I think, if you know,
seasonal?
It's good. No, I worked, I was an intern. So I did work for full-time during grad school.
Oh, good.
The whole year, but...
Yeah, probably a good recommendation for folks, huh?
Yeah, you know, definitely look for those pathways, student internships. Those are really helpful during school because you could work in the summer, you could work on your breaks, or you could work the whole year if, you know, you're in the area and that works out with your school schedule.
Yeah, that'd be great. And then getting all that experience, hands-on experience while you're probably learning some of it too, right?
Right, and it helps in the classroom too because you're not always going to kind of encounter the same stuff in the classroom that you will in your professional boots-on-the-ground career, you know?
Yeah.
So it's always good to have that balance of doing both.
Yeah, especially from how my brain is, that'd be great. Like, I'm a hands-on kind of person, so being able to get both and being able to relate, like, oh, yes, this is what I was doing with my boss out in the field, and then this is kind of similar, and then I can start connecting dots, and the big picture kind of comes in. But otherwise, if I don't, you know, sometimes I can just have dots and not, like, connect it all together because I'm, like, you're missing that hands-on portion of it, you know. I think that's why, like, firefighting was pretty easy for me. Or not easy, I mean, kind of, I guess, but, like, it's a hard job, but it's easy for me to get it, really enjoy, I guess. It was easy for me to like because it was all hands-on stuff, you know, and learning the why and how to do it and, you know, tactics and stuff, you know, come with experience.
But
that's any other recommendations, I guess, in that kind of field?
Yeah, so like seasonal work is really great. Volunteer work, I mean, I definitely recommend doing, you know, federal work, state and local government work, private sector, if you can spend a season out there, like museum work, field work, like find your niche, figure out what you like to do, and then kind of focus on that. So for me, I really do enjoy working with museum collections. So I brought that with me here to the Root, where I do a lot of field work and a lot of compliance work with Section 106 and Section 110 in ARPA. And so I brought that with me, and we've been developing our museum program here.
Oh, cool.
And so working to create a new curation facility, which we're putting together in the next few months. Creating like a whole catalog that encompasses not just what's at the SO but what's at the ranger districts, and that way it'll be a lot easier for us to exhibit these things and also kind of allow students to come in and research different topics based on the artifacts that we have.
I like everything you said there. That sounds awesome. And is there going to be with the new curation, I'm trying to think of the word that you just said about exhibits, I guess. Are they going to be like public exhibits or more just for... Oh, cool.
Yeah, so we would do like a new exhibit up in the front desk area of the SO. We also might work with local museums and visitor centers to kind of put something together depending on kind of what their security measures are, because we have to kind of work within a specific set of guidelines.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I don't want anything walking off, you know?
Yeah, and not that they would. It's just where you have to be very specific with what we are working with.
Yeah.
Just in, like, the policies and guidance that we have.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think that's great because it gets more people interested because
yeah.
I think a lot of times folks think about the Forest Service, and if they haven't had any experience in fire, it's Forest Service is more like trails, you know, hiking.
Right.
And
which is fun.
Yeah, which is great. Yeah, like that's, you know, I mean, that's the meat and potatoes of us. But like then to have another reason to get maybe a different crowd in there, you know, like people just like, you know, like, oh, I heard about the Magruder Massacre or something, like if, you know, they stumble on this podcast and they're like, and I heard that, you know, there might be a display, you know, in the future, like you said, an exhibit going on at the SO, or like, come see some stuff that was found out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, connect some dots for people who heard the story here and then get to kind of picture.
You can look at the artifacts. You can kind of see more of the story.
Yeah. So. That definitely helps my brain too when I get to see things, you know.
And
It feels like you're more a part of it that way. And
yeah. I mean, this stuff is sitting in our curation facility, so it's good for us to put it on exhibit. To utilize it, you know.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, we just have like a bunch of bottles and metal fragments sitting in the cupboard, you know.
Yeah, totally. And in the dark, and you know, not getting anyone else to see it or anyone else to kind of enjoy it. And
right.
Yeah, there's this guy, and then to me, there's like energy besides like the energy that comes with like an artifact, you know. Like if you see something, like you really feel the moment a little bit, at least I do, you know, and maybe I'm sensitive, I don't know, but you know, like especially like the massacre thing I keep coming back to, because it's just like relevant from what we talked about. But like, you know, one of those like brass buckles, or we were talking about like from the pack string or whatever, you know, like seeing one of those like a person, I don't know, I feel like I get a little more connected to the site where it's like,
oh, absolutely,
a little more feeling from that, and like, oh man, there it is, you know.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we don't necessarily collect on our forest is these artifacts, specifically the pre-contact ones. I mean, that is their kind of resting place.
Yeah.
So when you remove that, you kind of remove that object from its kind of home.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. No. Totally. And I think we talked about that a little bit before about you know, finding like you said, pre-contact things and.
Yeah.
Getting in contact with the tribe who has the most connection to it and giving it kind of that proper send off, whatever it might be, or leaving it be, like you said, to let it rest where it is meant to rest.
Right.
I think that's powerful stuff there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you do important work, and I really appreciate
you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. So are you. I appreciate you as well.
Yeah, I'm trying, you know, just trying to keep up with big brains like you and Matt and all the other folks they have on here. So
you're doing a great job.
Oh, thanks. I really, like, more than I can put in words, I really appreciate that. And anything else before I let you go?
No.
Well, I appreciate you coming all the way out here.
The
Airstream's kind of stuck in its spot today. But
oh, it's okay.
Yeah. Thanks again. And thanks for everybody who's tuning in and following along.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Bye, everybody.